Hey there, this is Seth Juarez coming to you from NDC London 2016. My name is Seth Juarez. I'm here with a special guest. He has two names. Tell us who you are and what you do, bud.
My name is Owen Aney. I'm also known as Andrien. For historical reasons that I've repeated way too many times.
Yeah. There's a video that I did with him many years ago on this same subject.
Yeah. And I'm here speaking at the RavenDB booth in this conference.
So RavenDB, why don't you talk a little bit about what RavenDB is and when is a good use case?
RavenDB is a document database. Mm-hmm. That means that it stores data not in relational format with rows and columns. Mm-hmm. It stores information in documents.
Right.
And documents are JSON objects. Mm-hmm. And because they're JSON, that means that you can start working with them in any way, shape, and form. So the trivial example is take an order. Mm-hmm. An order is composed of some header fields, and then you have the order lines. Mm-hmm. In a relational database, if you take the simplest possible schema like Northwind, the orders actually sits in four or five tables.
Yeah.
You have the orders, the order lines, you have discounts, you have payments, you have coupons, blah, 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 whole bunch of stuff. Now, when you want to see just a single order, that means you have to touch all of those tables.
Joins, yeah.
Yes. Now, think about the poor database engine. You ask it, think about it from the database engine point of view. You ask it, okay, give me the order, join it to the order lines, join it to the payments, join it to the discount, join it to, help.
Yeah, there's a lot of work to do.
Yeah, and then you ask it, okay, I need to go here and here and here and here and here and here just to get a crumble of this information. And in many cases, joins also mean a non-trivial computation.
Right.
So for a very long time, I was dealing with database performance issues. Mm-hmm. I would come to a company, they had performance problems, I would fix them and I would go away. Unfortunately, I realized that I was doing the same work over and over and over again.
Right.
I would come, I would find the selected plus one, I would find the query without the index, I would find where a single page was generating thousands of queries per page view. I would fix that and move on. And it was, you know, on one hand, the first time that you do it.
A lot of work.
Yeah. Yes. Way too much work for me to handle. And on a personal basis, you know, first time that you improve the system performance by 500%, you're on the top of the world.
Yeah.
Yes. And the same time that you only improve the software performance by 500%, that was a sucky day at the office.
Yeah.
And at that point, I says, okay, let me shift a bit, and instead of working for customers to improve their performance, let's write a tool that will do the same thing.
Right.
And that's what I did, and I started I started selling the tool, and that was wonderful.
What was the tool? Was it
That was the Enhibit Profiler, and now we also have the Entity Framework Profiler. Right. And what they effectively do, they sit between your application and the database, and they run an analysis of all of the network traffic, all of the database traffic. So you can do that in a SQL Server. You have the SQL Profiler.
Right.
And it's great if you need to look at things from the database point of view. But in many cases, especially in development and production, what you actually want to see, I want to see the database activity from the point of view of the code.
Got it.
Because I need to know
what queries are being generated.
Yes, and in what context. So if you know I have a website that generates, you know, 200 queries per second. There is a very major difference if this happens on, you know, 50 queries per second, 50 requests per second generating 200 queries per second. Mm-hmm. Or if you know we have one request that generated 100 queries per request. You also need to know what are the access patterns that you have. You know, at this point, we got it down to the point where we actually analyze the database schema compared to the kind of queries that you're offering, saying, okay, you're running this query on a field that isn't indexed, or you need to, this query cannot be indexed, we analyze the query plan that you have here and all bunch of other stuff like that. But the core thing still remains, okay, let me tell you the database operation that your system is running to the actual code that you're executing.
I see.
In many cases, the problem here is that you don't actually know. Think about it. If you work on a modern application, you typically have some sort of an ORM, and you write, and you know, you care about making the page look pretty, making sure that the UX is working, making sure that, you know, okay, I need to do Twitter integration here, so mm-hmm. I need to make sure that you don't care about the database until very late in the game. And the more powerful tools you have, the more they effectively get out of the way and let you do the, you know, what is effectively the real work. But then you go to production, and suddenly you realize that by going away, you have created this huge, almost impossible to disentangle mess, where a single page now, in order to meet what it needs to do a whole bunch of database work. And in many cases, you can say, the moment that you see that, oh yeah, I need to add these two lines here, and this will fix the problem. But in some cases, I gave a talk today about a bug tracking system called Bugnet. And in this bug tracking system, in order to load a single issue, you had to touch 17 tables.
Now, that's a lot.
Do you remember SQL Server 2000? That SQL Server 2000 had a limit of 16 joins per query, hence the phrase 17 joins, as an impossibly costly thing. By the way, right now, SQL Server 2013, 15, whatever this is now, the limit is 256 joins per query. And I'm really sad to know that fact.
Oh my goodness.
Because I've seen people who hit that limit and bounce, and then get upset.
So you wrote this profiler mm-hmm. because you were finding out that a lot of the customers were having the same issues.
Exactly.
And then you wrote this profiler, and sorry, so I remember the profiler. Mm-hmm. It was very powerful, very very well written.
But it then still is, by the way.
You must have come to another point in time where just like, okay, databases, maybe I'm just...
So the problem was that, okay, so I now automated the process of finding where the problems are. The problem is that I was still called a lot to answer questions. But okay, now I know why we suck, how we can suck less. And in certain cases...
there was no answer, right?
Okay, I was actually in London, some tiny little town about 20 minutes south of London in 2008. And I was there to do consulting for a company that does risk management. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, they had a trivia in the system. And the trivia was very complex, and it has security implications on that. Now, the problem was that in certain organizations that were very big and had very specific security controls, you weren't allowed to see some parts of the tree. So they wrote something in SQL to do that, and then they realized that in this particular organization, clicking on a node in the tree would cost upward of 40 seconds. That's 40 seconds.
Ooh.
On a single user, by the way.
Right.
If you have multiple users, then the time would increase and sometimes you die. So the problem then is that, okay, let's optimize that.
Right.
And they brought a really awesome DBA, and he was able to optimize that magnificently. Honestly, I had to sit, afterward, I had to sit with him and figure out how he did it because it was, you know, a thing of beauty. And he managed to improve the performance by 100%. So now it only took 20 seconds. And at that point, I came in, and what I effectively did was I cheated. And I said, okay, instead of making all of the queries in the database, let's say that this table moves to its own database. And instead of querying the database, we have a small service that serves to answer questions about this.
Right.
And if we do that, then we can do interesting things like let's load the entire thing into memory and store it in a hash table. Now, at that point, instead of doing a recursive queries in the table, you could do pointer arithmetics to just jump between the nodes in dramatically faster time.
Right.
So once we have done doing that, and the reason we needed a service, so only the service could update the database, and the database now became the just the persistent mechanism, not the query mechanism.
Right.
And so once we've done that, the query time was 5 milliseconds.
Wow, that's quite a jump, 40
yeah.
seconds, 5 milliseconds.
Yes, now the problem was that, and you know, now when I'm looking at that, databases are awesome because the kind of things that you asked it to do was crazy. And when we changed it to the in-memory implementation, it needed to do even more computation, but because we didn't have to play around with, you know, joints and all sorts of stuff like that, it just went insanely fast. Now, and that was the kind of thing that I had to do for a long while, you know, going to places and, okay, I skipped all of the boring part, you know, add this method here to prevent you from doing lazy loads and stuff like that. But the key thing here is that, now I still, you know, run into problems, more interesting problems certainly, but and I couldn't think about it. You come and you see, how could you ever get to this point?
Where it's working perfectly.
Yeah, no. It's the problem wasn't working perfectly. How could you get into this point and not realize that something is broken?
Yeah, right.
I mean,
I see.
Thousands of page. Thousands of queries per page, and you didn't think it was a problem. At some point, I used to have this little spiel about punishing your biggest client. So your system would work perfectly for, you know, the small clients, the one that pay $5-$10 a month, and then typically in most systems you have, you know, the 3-4 big clients that, you know, pay thousands of dollars a month, and for the small clients, the system would be speedy and fast and everything because they had small amount of data.
Right.
The big clients that pay a lot of money were working with a whole bunch of data and they were slow and painful. And that was just horrendous.
You're punishing your best customers.
Exactly. Which makes very little sense. And, you know, from business perspective, from what the customer expects and stuff like that. And at that point, what I decided to do is that, you know what, I can't blame you.
Yeah.
You're not stupid. You're not malicious. You're not doing this to me on purpose.
Right.
Okay. It sometimes felt like that, but the point was that you were using the tools that you had, and you know what? Honestly, a solution like the let's load everything to memory and do that as a service is a good solution for high priority, high value targets, but it's not something that you want to do across the board.
Right. You have because to persist eventually.
Yeah. Not even just to persist, that the amount of code that you have to write and the level of complexity. Okay, so this service now needs to be multi-threaded safe. This service needs to handle what happens if you have a concurrent modification, a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, you may have people who can write it, but you don't want to do it all over the place.
Right.
Because then the level of complexity in your code goes way up. And suddenly you have, you know, a junior dev that's, okay, now I'm writing, you know, a web API endpoints to get some data to show on the screen, and suddenly I'm in a code that where the consideration of memory alignment took us 2 weeks to get right.
Right.
So, and, you know, you don't see these kind of things. And unless you have seen that, okay, I had a piece of code where changing a single call meant that whatever we would allocate or not allocate a string in a particular location, and one of the guys, you know, went over that, saw crappy piece of code, honestly, really really crappy, and fixed that. And performance dropped by 15% because suddenly this piece of code that didn't used to do allocations suddenly did tremendous amount of allocations. And at that point, you know, I look at this, why did you do that? Because it's crappy code. Yes, I know, but it's crappy for purpose. So we revert the change, then put a big statement. Here are all of the things that you need to consider when you change this code.
Yeah.
And it's funny, but that's you really need to do that.
So you came to a place where you were noticing that the database, the way it was engineered, was not sufficient for certain kinds of tasks.
Yeah, so think about it. When did we start using relational databases as an industry?
We had memory constraints.
And memory constraints, disk constraints, and the kind of applications we were writing were very, very different.
Sure.
Consider a web page from the 90s. Mm-hmm. Okay, what kind of experience you would have? You would have, you know, master details.
Right.
That would be wow. I remember articles in magazines, physical magazines. That was the thing there. It's sad for me to a thing there like 20.
Not anymore, dude.
Yes, like 20. I can speak about stuff that happened 20 years ago. And so I remember articles that explain how you can do master details because it's complex, you need to consider so many stuff and blah, blah, blah. And then you realize that, okay, right now in a single page, you're expected to show the entire data that the user is interested in.
Yeah.
And that means that suddenly you have to go to all of those tables, all of those information sources and show them. It's just insane.
So when did you come to the point where you decided, I'm going to make a document database?
I never did that.
Okay.
So what happened is that I started daydreaming.
Uh-huh.
Like, at one point I was going back home and I was like, I wish I had a database that could do this.
Yeah.
And I wish it could do that. And then suddenly, you know, I started, you know, imagining the perfect database. Mm-hmm. You know, you daydream about stuff. Some people daydream about a day at the beach. I dream apparently about
good
database.
Yeah.
So, but unfortunately, it didn't, like, at some point I realized that I woke up at 2 a.m. and I'm staring at the ceiling and I see the flow of data into the indexing engine and I'm marking to myself, okay, here I need to be aware of a parallel processing consideration.
Sure.
Here we need to do some IO optimizations. And I'm like, the next day I'm like, wow, I had this great vision yesterday of exactly how it's supposed to look like. And like, but I'm not in the business of building databases. Right. Only crazy people build databases.
Yeah. Or people that have done it forever.
Yes. Yeah. Like, if you look at this, most of the people in the database who build database have built databases for a long time.
Yeah.
And
it's not a trivial thing, incidentally.
No. One of there's a guy called Howard Chu from he works on Open LDAP, mm-hmm. And the company is called Simus Consulting, I think. So he wrote LMDB, which is a low-level key-value store, mm-hmm. That has amazing performance. And when you talk to him, you have to understand that you talk to him and he's able to recall to you specific details about machine architecture, hardware, stuff that, okay, you need to consider that because if you do that, then this project from 15 years ago did that and
wow.
Like amazing, amazing person to talk to and bounce an idea off. So.
1 second, pause. My ran out of battery there for a second. Give me 1 second. About that. All right. So you were talking about how we built a key value store.
Yeah. So Howard, let me refer. I'm going mentally back in my head. So when you talk to Howard, he's able to give you reasoning that is really, really deep.
Right.
I mean, think about it. You talk to him, okay, what happened if we do that? He said, oh yeah, this project does that and it has these advantages, disadvantages.
Wow.
And that project, we have tried that already, and this project has failed because of blah, 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 blah. And that's a really...
It's a good resource to
have. Yeah,
he's
an amazing person to talk to. But, you don't do stuff like that on your own because that would be just crazy.
Yeah, right.
And unfortunately, at some point, I realized that I couldn't sleep. Like, I'm trying to fall asleep, and I see database moving. You know, shapes moving in my head.
He didn't count sheep, he counted databases.
Generally. Yes. And suddenly you realize, okay, how do I process this query and oh no, I can't do that. That's a security implication if you want to expose this API. And like, seriously, get out of my head.
Yeah.
And at some point I says, okay, I'm going to do the responsible thing. I'm going to write a design document. Sure. For this database. I'm just going to throw it in my blog and let me get it out of my head because that was driving me crazy.
Sure.
And I did that and that worked for about a month. And then I start thinking, I think that I had a mistake in this design doc.
I gotta go back and fix it.
Yes, and then, you know, oh, never mind. I'm just going to spike it. I'm just going to write a tiny little spike. But what I'm talking about happened in 2008, 2009, stuff like that. And I'm writing a spy code, and I'm, you know, this is the weekend. That's fun, you know.
Yeah, it's fun stuff.
Yeah, you write code because not for a purpose, because you write code and it's the exciting thing of getting something to work. And I started working on the weekend, and 3 weeks later, I realized that I don't actually do any real work. I'm spiking.
Yeah.
And at that point, me and the database sat down and had a discussion. Actually, it was hostile negotiation. And this hostile negotiation went something like this. If I give you a certain amount of money, will you go away? And no. So I says, okay, let's pull up a napkin and write down a business plan and says, okay, I can't just ignore you. You've taken up too much mental space. So let's say that I'm going to give you 2 years, try to make you a product, and after 2 years, when I've proved that you're a commercial failure, then you can go away and not bother me again.
Nice.
And that was in late 2009, and that was the point where I decided, okay, let's make Remedy be a product. And I had this whole, you know, this much time, this much money, this is where this is my line in the sand.
You gotta draw a line.
Yes,
here.
This is my second line in the sand, and this is when this is where I'm actually going to stop.
Yeah.
And in May of 2010, we actually had the first 1.0 release of RavenDB. And I was very happy. I think that we did some really cool stuff there. Looking back, by the way, really crappy stuff. Like, again, we're talking about five, 6 years of active development since then. So we really came up with that.
Yeah.
And, you know, okay, so it's out. People can start looking at that, experimenting with that. And hopefully by late 2011, we'll have someone that is trusting us enough to go to production. And in November of 2010, we suddenly have, hi, just to let you know that we're running in production for a while now and we're very happy. Uh-huh. And like, wow, really?
So someone was using the product that early.
I was starting to move our own properties to RavenDB to, you know, dog food and stuff. And, but someone, and it's funny.
Oh, looks like we're out.
Out of the second button.
What's that?
We are out of the second battery?
Yeah, so I can fix that. So what we're going to do is I'm going to turn this off. And then I'm going to go like this.
This is also a charger?
What's that?
This is also, it's plugged in.
Yeah. We're just going to move this over here like so. And then this goes right. Very good. So you got a customer.
Yeah. So I got a customer, and I'm like, wow, really? it's funny because, you know, we were working very hard to make sure that this happens.
Uh-huh.
But the businessman says that I have at least 6 months before this is going to happen.
Yeah.
And it was in October that we got one customer, because in November, remember, we got two customers.
Nice.
And I charted the progression from these two data points, and I think that something in May of 2012, according to that, in May of 2011, according to that data point, I was supposed to be the only database in the planet. But anyway, things started happening, and very quickly people started going on this database, and the funny thing is that We didn't have a lot then, but the one thing that almost from the get-go, we had a couple of really important things. One of them was the modeling aspect that dramatically changed the complexity of working with the database. And the second was that from the get-go, because what I was doing all the time was fix other people's problem with databases, was let's be proactive about it. So for example, think about the kind of issues that you run into with good code with databases.
Well, there's an impedance mismatch.
Yeah,
clearly.
So the major problem is modeling, but that's that. Ignore that. You have a very simple model, no impedance mismatch. Uh-huh. So the common issues is stuff like table scans, too many joins, too many queries to the database because you're doing a select plus one, those kind of things. Another really costly thing is when you have queries that cannot be optimized, they cannot be indexed, computation during queries, those kind of things. So it really, from the get-go, says, okay, let's define two things. Let's define the things that we're not going to support because there is no way to support them efficiently. Mm-hmm. And B, let's define the things that we can support because we can support them efficiently. Let's define the things that we have to do in order to call ourselves a production database.
Sure.
So for example, RevDB is ACID. Atomic is isolated, durable, in other words, it has transactions. In other words, you can modify multiple documents at the same transaction and be sure that either all of them goes in or none of them goes out, or all of them goes in or none of them goes in as a single atomic unit.
Right, so that if someone were to read it later on, they wouldn't get some weird collision.
Yes, so it will not get, which apparently is a new thing for NoSQL databases, which was like, this is a database, a transaction. Another thing that drives me crazy is the notion of a transaction for safety. You know, I'm used to, you know, when I brought something to the database, the database is actually going to, you know, no matter what happened, it's going to be there when it wakes up. If I pull the plug, if, you know, I turn stuff off, it works. And
that doesn't happen with certain kinds of caching, for example, caching databases.
But cache database is something I accept. Okay, if you run in memory, perfectly valid.
Yeah.
But if, so one of the things that you have to do with databases is I/O. In fact, one of the things that you have to do with databases is the management of resources, compute, memory, and I/O. Mm-hmm. So with the most costly of them, by the way, is typically I/O, because going to disk takes forever and a half. Uh-huh. And the access pattern in which you go to this matters quite a lot. So I just give you some idea. Let's say that you want to do something trivial. You want to write, write all text, uh-huh. and the file name is name.txt, and the value is set. Uh-huh. Okay, you do that. Now what happens? What happens is the following sequence of events. A, your file call writes to user mode buffer. Uh-huh. At some point, that user mode buffer will be written to the kernel buffer. Mm-hmm. The kernel buffer will transfer that to the file system buffer. The file system buffer will transfer that to the device driver buffer. The device driver buffer will transfer that at some point to the disk, where you have another buffer.
Right.
By the way, typically you have multiple buffers on the disk. And the reason that you have so many buffers is just going to this is such an expensive thing to do.
Yeah, it is.
And that means that, and if any point of time someone pulls the plug, or there is some kind of error, you close the file. As far as you're concerned, everything is fine. And it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
Which drives you crazy. So you have to use a specific, either you have to use a specific command like fsync, but fsync is incredibly expensive. To the point on standard hardware, you can call fsync a few hundred times a second, and that's on server level hardware. Mm-hmm. So that means that you only have several hundred transactions per second available to you.
Interesting.
So, or you can use a unbuffered I/O. But unbuffered I/O has its own consequences for performance. It's much, much faster, but it's in much slower than buffered I/O. Mm-hmm. Much faster than using fsync, because fsync has implication for the entire system, because it forced the entire operating system to flush its caches, its disk cache.
So how do you get, how did you, like, I mean, I feel like we're in the I/O weeds here.
Yeah.
How do you get this stuff to work fast if you're making your own databases? Obviously, you want to make sure you have ACID, but you need to make sure you need to write stuff out.
So
there were some
mostly,
things,
mostly we cheated.
Yeah.
We started out by using a lot of pre-existing components. Mm-hmm. So we used Ecent, which is an embedded database that actually comes with Windows. That's mm-hmm. That's the backbone of Exchange and Active Directory. Mm-hmm. And we used Lucene for searching, and then we plugged all of the behavior around that. And that was RevenDB 1.0. Since then, it's really limiting if you, as a database, you really need to control every little bit.
Yeah.
So we wrote our own storage engine. It's called Voron. And what it does is it's really efficient. A way of managing the data.
Right.
Effective. So there are two things that you need to consider. You get safety or you get speed, and
right.
It's really, really complex to balance the two. So the fastest way to write a disk is, you know, mmap the file, just memory map the entire file and just write it to it directly. But then you have issues. Okay, what happens if you try to modify the same record concurrently?
Right.
In memory, if you do that, then that's really complex. And even more than that, if you need to maintain a transaction integrity, that means that, think about it, if I modify a particular record, uh-huh. haven't committed that yet, and you're going in to read that, then either I need to handle a really complex lock-in, which is...
Which is going to cause throughput yeah. issues.
Yes. Or I can try to find something else. With Vorn, what we have done, we use, in database terms, snapshot isolation. Uh-huh. Internally, what happened is that we use a copy on write. So whenever you open a transaction, you effectively have a snapshot of the entire database as it was at the time of opening the transaction. Mm-hmm. Then you start making modification. You have your own copy of the modification. When you commit, then we sync everything together. And then we realize that in Vorn we have three different kinds of file. Mm-hmm. We have the transaction log into which you have to write in order to commit a transaction, and you write the transaction log, and that's where you write using unbuffered I/O, uh-huh. because okay, I need this to hit disk, and you know I will pay as much as I need because that's core yeah. component of what I had to do. But even then you can start playing tricks, because you use unbuffered I/O, the size of what you write in really important. So
sure.
what we can do, we can trade off space for time. So I know that writing, you know, a 10 kilobyte is going to cost me, I don't know, 3 milliseconds. Mm-hmm. Writing a 2 kilobytes is going to cost me 1 second. So if compressing this information that I'm going to write to the disk actually takes less time than writing it completely, mm-hmm. that's a really good trade-off that I want to make.
Sure.
And actually the numbers are much higher than what I just gave. So we did that. We also when you do unbuffered I/O, you really have to worry about alignment issue of the memory of the position, the file, a whole bunch of stuff like that. Other things, like, it's funny, but the whole bunch of tricks about writing to disk fast, like we never just write to the end of the file.
Right.
When we create a file, we pre-allocate the entire file and we ask the operating system, look, don't just say that you have a file of size X. I want you to actually physically go and allocate all of the data on disk. So when I ask you write to position Y, you know where this is, and you don't incur the cost of, okay, I need to find and do all sorts of organization.
So it seems like Voron is that what it's called? It's
yeah.
doing a lot of sort of the optimizations for doing the I/O.
Yeah.
Did you stick with Lucene for the indexing?
So, yes. So that's really depend on which version of RevenDB we're talking about. Voron is the low-level storage engine.
Right.
This is basically how we transactionally write to the disk. On top of, so, before we move to the other stuff. Mm-hmm. So before we have the transaction log, and we have a really work really hard to make sure that we optimize the writing to the log file. Mm-hmm. But the moment it is, okay, once I've committed the transaction in the log file, I'm free, because if something happens, I can just recover from the log file. That means that I can actually write the data directly to memory and not worry about, you know, what happened if someone pulls the plug. I will just recover from the log file. That means that we have in Vuln, we have the data file, which is just a memory map file. And then we have scratch buffers, which are on the side. So let's say I need to modify this page. So I need to modify this record. This record actually sits on a page. So I'm copying this page to scratch buffer. And now all of the read transactions still see the old value. And then I start modifying it here. Finish with the transaction, I'm committing all of the changes to the journal file. Mm-hmm. And then I can play with the page translation table. Now when you go to a page three, instead of going to it in the data file, you go in the scratch buffer.
I see.
And that means that I don't have to pay the immediate cost of moving things around or actually going to disk. I can buffer that and batch that, which is much, much, much more efficient.
I see.
So this is what we did with Vuln. I think that at last benchmark, we can do millions of writes to disk. So transaction of writes to disk on my laptop.
Got it.
Okay. On production server, we saw some ridiculous numbers, but I don't have the latest numbers in my head.
And that's okay, right?
Yeah.
So Vuln is the sort of the I/O sort of piece.
Exactly.
Of RavenDB. Lucene is the thing that does the indexing for your searches.
Yes. So and then you have other components in the system. So you write the documents to RavenDB. We store it in the document store, the Vuln store, and then we tunnel that to the indexing to start indexing. And indexing driven be just link expressions that go over your documents and find out the interesting pieces that you want, mm-hmm. and then just write it and move on with your life. And then when you query the index, it's really, really fast. Using Lucene also means that we aren't, so typically in database indexes, the order of the index is really, really important, because if you index first by name and then by first by last name and then by first name, it's not possible in a relational database, in most NoSQL databases, to say, okay, I want to get the results, but I want to get them
backwards. Yeah,
I want to get sorted by first name and then by last name.
Yeah,
it can do that. With Lucene, you can do that because it uses a completely different format. So That's roughly where we're at now. We've done a lot of work on the kind of services that you want from the database. Mm-hmm. So a trivial example, okay? Most of the time when you write data, you write data rarely, but read it mostly.
Right.
So with RavenDB, every request that you make to the database, every response from the database has an etag. And on every request, you can send that etag to the server. And the server has an optimized code path just to see if the result of this request have changed based on this ETAG. And if they haven't changed, what we can do, we can just give you nothing was modified. So on the client side, we have a very simple cache implementation. This is when you make a request to this query, when you get back, you get an ETAG. Just remember this. Next time you get to the same
point, we'll tell you if you're fine
yes.
or not, or
so,
you refetch.
A couple of really interesting things happen at this point. One, you don't have for free, basically you get caching.
Right.
And you get authoritative caching. So if something changed, you go to the server to check that something
right.
happened, and you get the result back. But if not, the server didn't have to execute the query, the network didn't have to transfer all of the data, it's like free money. It's
right.
like free performance from this feature. And then people started saying, you know what? People sometimes are really spoiled, especially when they're me. So what happened is that I still pay the cost of going to the server. And as it turned out, at some point, we start profiling things on a deep level. It says, okay, we spend way too much time going to the server, like 2 milliseconds. And could we save even the time to go to the server? And we have another feature which basically allows you to subscribe to changes from the database. If you say, okay, I want to know, we started doing that for applications where you need to edit a document and you might need to edit it for a long time, and then someone also edits that. So we did that, and you can say, okay, whenever someone changes this document, I want you to call me back.
I see.
This is that. This is very similar to how SignalR does that. It uses WebSocket or a server-side events, and it's very, it's pretty efficient and nice. And you just say, okay, if something changed here, just let me know.
Right.
So we, when we implement that, we say, okay, let's tie it to the caching, and now you can say, okay, I want to cache aggressively. That means that whenever you make a request, if it's in the cache, we don't even go to the server to do that. Instead, what we say, dear server, let us know when anything changes, in which case we will go back to you and see if the etag that we have is current or not.
Right. And usually because you're not having, when you're working in a particular session in your application, you're not going to have a whole gigabytes and gigabytes of data. You're going to have this subset of data, and you're going to have it in cache, and then if it changes, it'll come back.
Yeah. And, you know, it's ridiculous. I remember when a web node was less powerful than my phone. And now a web node, you know, a trivial web node is, you know, a 16, 20, 32 gigabyte of memory.
Yeah.
And quad or a octa core.
I don't know.
Yeah. Like four or eight core. That's the standard web node. Why not, you know, and why try to be optimal about memory usage there?
Right.
If I can, you know, take 3 gigabyte of the web memory to save the time to go to, that's a really good decision to make. And so we have features that, I mentioned that going to the server is expensive. So we have a feature that says, okay, let's say that you need to run a whole bunch of queries. You want to load the custom, you want to get the number of purchases this customer made, you want to get the messages, the unread messages for this customer, a whole bunch of stuff. So you can do it like this: go to the server, go to the server, go to the server, and it works. But you know,
so there should be some latency there.
Yes, there's some latency, and it's funny because at some point people start complaining because just going to the server was the most expensive part. So you can trace that in Feeder. Going to the server is 2 milliseconds. Time on the server is 0 millisecond, and then going back. And then it says, okay, let's change things. Instead, okay, we have an API that says, okay, I want to make this request, but I want to make this request lazily. So you have a whole bunch of requests that you say, okay, I'm operating all of them lazily. And then the first time that you access one of those requests, we take all of the pending requests and execute and send them to the server in a single round trip. On the server side, we actually says, oh, I got a bunch of requests. Let's execute them all in parallel on the server side.
Oh, I see.
So you save tremendous amount of effort.
It feels like there's tons of really good features. I mean, I wish we could talk about it some more, but if you could boil it down to RavenDB, this is what it is. Does it work on the cloud? Is it something that you should use in your application? Is there a time where you shouldn't use it? If you could summarize this for us and then tell us where we can go and
so
learn more.
RavenDB can run on anything from 01666 with 667, sorry, with 512 megabytes of memory to you know, I think the biggest machine that I see a customer run it was 128 gigabyte memory and 64 cores, probably.
Oh my goodness.
Yes, and they were pissed because we're only using 30 gigabytes of memory. it's funny, sometimes you get support requests that are, you know, you're not using enough memory. Is it fast?
Yeah,
it's fast, but use more memory.
Use more memory. Yeah. I've never had that, so.
Yeah. We replaced a pre-existing database solution that needed everything and more, and like, we pay so much money for this server, we're not using enough of it.
Yeah.
But we're doing the work and it's fast. Anyway, you can use it on the cloud in Azure and AWS through RavenHQ, which is available on either RavenHQ.com or the Azure store or the AWS store,
right.
I think. You should use it for pretty much all OLTP applications. That's what it was meant for. Most of our clients at the time were building business application, and I explicitly designed the database to be about just that. Best database that I could dream of for business applications.
Got it.
You shouldn't use RavenDB if you don't care about every individual data point. So what do I mean by that? Let's say that, so I have a watch, the watch measures my heart rate and it reports it to some server. I really don't think that I will ever care what my heart rate was at a particular point in time.
I see.
What I care about is, okay, show me the graph. Oh, right. There I was at the gym, there I was sleeping, there something happened, I don't know, maybe I'm dead.
Right.
So that's what I care about. So if you don't care about every individual thing, then this is not, this shouldn't be in the document database. If you care about individual things, that it certainly should. The nice thing about, I'm just going to do 2 minutes about modeling.
Sure, sure.
The nice thing about working with RavenDB is that you can literally see how the thing should look like because, okay, let's look at the page.
Uh-huh.
This page is your document. You displayed it to the user. This is what actually should be in the database pretty much as is. And some people have very hard time of that because of relational modeling concepts.
Sure, sure.
But once you realize that, okay, this is not a shared database. This is not something that you're supposed to use from 10 different applications.
Right.
Have 10 different ways of working with the data. Instead, what we do, we have a single database per application, and it's meant to serve that. So why store the information in a way that isn't suitable for this application? Who is only consumer of this data? And you model that, and you and suddenly thinks, okay, in order to process this page, I need to make one, two queries, load this document, and I'm done. So basically, the database goes out of your way, and you're free to work. Another thing that happens is that, so we have indexes, and indexes are typically used for searching a particular document. But you can also use MapReduce indexes. And MapReduce indexes are basically, okay, let's take a whole bunch of indexes and aggregate them in some manner. If you take the online store example, then let's say that you have products, you have 100 million orders and 10,000 products. And I want to see how many products I've sold of each product.
Right.
So that's a report, that's a fairly standard report, it's a group by and you're done. However, what happens if I ask you, you know what, I want to show on the products page, I want to show how many items I sold from this product. And then if you use a relational database and you just use a group by, something very interesting happens. This group by is going to be very fast. Again, assuming that you have the appropriate indexes on SQL, it's going to be very fast for the small products, the one that no one goes to their pages. But if you go to a page, to a product for a that has, you know, 10 million sales, then you ask the database, okay, I want you to group me on that, and that's requiring O(n) of 10 million.
Yeah.
With RavenDB, because we do MapReduce, we actually process the entire thing in increments. So whenever there is a change, we just need to update the resulting thing. So when you query, instead of doing an O(n) of 10 or 100 million, you're actually doing an O log n of 10,000 to get already pre-computed results. That's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. We don't try to compete by doing the same thing faster. We do something completely different that serves the same need, and the performance characteristics and the operation characteristics of that are completely off the scale for what you need to do.
Well, that's awesome. Where can people go to find out more about RavenDB?
RavenDB.net.
And also, you are a prolific writer of your blog. Why don't you tell people where your blog is?
Allende.com. Or you can just search for Allende and Allende Ryan or Oren Any and you get that. I'm still stuck with Allende.
I don't know why. That's what you chose.
See the previous show.
That's right. Well, thanks so much for spending time with us. Okay. Tons of information. It was just flowing right at us. Take a look at RavenDB.net. And then you can look at Allende.com for his writings. Thanks so much for being with us, bud.
You're welcome.
Again, we're here at NDC London 2016. My name is Seth Juarez. This is Channel 9. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time. Take care.